This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The XX GabFest is sponsored by Squarespace. Try the new Squarespace 7 with a redesigned interface, integrations with Getty Images and Google Apps, new templates, and a great feature called Cover Pages. Get 10% off when you go to squarespace.com and enter offer code XX. That's D-O-U-B-L-E-X. And by The Great Courses, offering engaging audio and video lectures taught by top professors. Courses like Fundamentals of Photography. Right now, get 80% off the original price when you visit thegreatcourses.com/XX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX GabFest for Thursday, March 19th, the Does Chore Play Turn You On edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer at Slate. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
Before we begin, I want to make a little announcement. We are looking for an intern. It's about a five-hour-a-week job. We need help preparing for segments, doing all sorts of cool, fun social media stuff. So if you are interested, please email us at xxgabfest@slate.com. That's xxgabfest@slate.com. And put intern in the subject line. Okay. So let's jump in. Our three topics today. First, we're going to talk about chore play, a new word in the feminist lexicon, which forces us to consider the terrible question, when your man does the laundry, do you find him sexy? Second, a landmark Silicon Valley trial tests whether the industry is sexist. We talk to a reporter who's been covering it. And third, an intimate look at maternity leave. We talk to Jessica Winter, who is just back to Slate from having her first baby. So let's jump right in with chore play. In a recent op-ed, Sheryl Sandberg used a term that's been bubbling up in feminist research circles, chore play. The image she used in the op-ed was of a man doing the laundry while the woman watched, and then an understanding rises between them that later he will get some. Don't you guys think that's a fair description? Like, I'm not saying she said that he was going to get some. It was just like an understanding arose between them.
It was bubbling under.
Yeah. I mean, it was just like there in the air. Whether she found him actually sexy or it was like a return favor is hard to say. But the larger idea is that marriage equality is good and that couples who share household duties also have more sex. I just want to start with the basics. Have you guys heard that term before? Was that new to you, chore play, when you read that piece?
It was new to me.
That was definitely new to me.
She couldn't have made it up, right?
Why not? She made up Lean In.
Oh, really? Huh.
No, I don't know.
She doesn't strike me as like a rhyming gal, like foreplay, chore play, but maybe. Okay. So do you think what she was saying is that when you see your man doing the laundry, you find it genuinely sexy? Or is it like a tit for tat? Like, you did one for me, I'm going to do one for you later. Like, what was the spirit of the thing?
For me, it was not necessarily that I will reward your laundry folding with some action, but I did maybe get a whiff of perhaps, but if you do bugger all about the house, you will not be getting any.
Right.
Which is sort of old-fashioned,
right.
Actually.
It's totally Lysistrata type stuff.
I think that chore play is just a pun they couldn't resist. It's sort of like if you come up with it, you can't not use it.
Right.
But they can't believe it's a real thing.
No, it literally, she writes, chore play is real. So she does, because that is literally a quote from within the op-ed.
Well,
so she does actually believe that it is real.
I hope it's like a really kinky scenario that is actually just like a weird fetish thing that Sheryl Sandberg is into.
Yes.
Because then that would be cool. But otherwise, I don't know.
Yeah, but who isn't the woman supposed to wear the maid uniform in the kinky scenario? Like what? He wears the maid uniform?
No, I think that's the kinky scenario, the second one. Maybe we should edit that out.
No, we should definitely not edit it out. So, okay. So, Noreen, it is not, here's the thing. It's not a fake thing because it's actually, there is a debate over the research. Like, don't you remember that New York Times Magazine cover story that was like, is marriage equality, like, ruin your sex life? Like, this is a genuine debate about the modern marriage. So, yes, chore play is a funny word, but like, there is some idea that if you are, do equal chores in your marriage, like, that's better overall. That's totally better, which I think is completely wrong, but
oh,
I mean, I think it's 90% right and 10% very wrong.
I think it's probably as good for your marriage as a non-married person. It sounds great to me if there is some equal sharing of chores. It does not sound like it is related to your sex life necessarily.
I'm familiar just from having moderated panel discussions with research from, say, Brazil, where I don't know why Noreen is laughing.
Well, I don't know. Just like
that was an odd sentence.
I have a lot of research at my fingertips, and let's just choose Brazil because that sounds kind of sexy.
That's where the guy was. That's where he did his research. Okay. And I'm going to read for you from. I'm going to read from this paper in Portuguese now. Okay,
oh.
You ready?
Oh.
No, not really. So this research was in the favelas. So like it was about people who could be killed if they weren't at home. And there it makes sense that if you are taking care of your children, if you're really bonded with your children, if you're committed to spending time with them, not only will you not be in situations where, you know, especially in places like, for example, I just read that book, Ghetto Side. It gave me the impression that in certain parts of Los Angeles, if you're a black man and you are not in your house, there is actually a decent chance that you will be killed or shot at or, you know, come into bodily harm just because of where you live. You don't have to be involved in gangs, but if you're in gang territory, you could be hurt. And I think in, yes, pretty extreme situations, it wouldn't surprise me one bit that if you are spending time with your child, if you're doing childcare, which always seems like, you know, you're not just taking care of your child. But anyway, if you're there in the home and you're making that bond, you're just not in the kind of danger that you might be in otherwise. So in that very specific context,
I don't think Sheryl Sandberg is doing a lot of research into the.
I don't either.
Sheryl Sandberg's field work does not go neither to the favela nor the ghetto.
However, like if she's, I did not follow the research that she linked to because it was an op-ed in the New York Times.
Wait, so bring it back home, June. So you're saying in the favela, if you're home and you're not dead, you're more sexy?
Well, the research, yes, if you're home and you're not dead, you are more sexy. Once you're dead, the sexiness decreases. But yeah, this research in Brazil did also find that you were likely to have more sex with your wife or with your partner if you did more childcare. So like, yes, there is research that suggests this, but that doesn't mean that, yeah, when we read Sheryl Sandberg and a Wharton professor, we don't immediately think of the wide world, we think of Sheryl Sandberg type people, or maybe people more or less like ourselves. And it doesn't seem to quite fit us. But like, so what I guess what I'm saying is the research is valid, I think, but doesn't necessarily apply to all groups, you know, across the socioeconomic universe.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think this is just an overly labored effort to make the modern egalitarian marriage, which, you know, me, Sheryl Sandberg, many of her friends are in, I'm sure you too, June, seem like perfect in every way. And so while it is better in most ways, like, of course, it's better to share the duties. It's better that everybody gets the opportunity, both that women get the opportunity to, you know, work hard at some points in their life if they want to, and that men get the opportunity to relax and spend more time with the children. Like, an excess of options is great. But we have not solved the problem of sex. Like, I am much more convinced by the research that shows that, in fact, that is the problem of the egalitarian marriage, is what happens to sex, because everybody becomes really friendly and there's just not a lot of mystery and everybody's everything to everyone. This is like the Esther Perel mating in captivity, what's wrong with the modern marriage style research. That's my first problem with this. And then my second problem with this chore play idea is that it really is insulting to the idea of the female libido to constantly equate it with, like, cozy comfort. Like, I just hate that evolutionary biology idea that all women want is to, like, cozy up. It just isn't true. And all the modern sex research from Daniel Bergner has, like, we've gotten a lot more interesting in understanding what turns women on. Like, we really have in the last few years. It's a lot of weird shit. It's not like, oh, a woman just wants a man to fluff up her pillow and then he'll get some. It's like, it denies that women have any, like, innate animal sexuality.
I raise your actual research and I draw your attention to the series of books and calendars called Porn for Women and Porn for Women of a Certain Age. And it was produced by the Cambridge Women's Pornography Collective. They came out in the late 2000s and they were pictures of guys like doing the laundry, guys, you know, taking out the trash, maybe making dinner. And the sexy words were things like, as long as I have two legs to walk on, you'll never take out the trash. Or, I love a clean house. And I mean, I suspect, obviously, they were gag gifts, but I think quite a few of those books were bought and given. So it's definitely in the ether.
But that joke works. Like, Monica Hess wrote a really, during the Anthony Weiner thing, Monica Hess was like, in the Washington Post, wrote a story that was like, we don't want to see a picture of your penis. Like, that's not what's turning me on. But if you, you know, move the expired food from the back of the fridge to the front of the fridge, then I'll be really turned on. Like, I think it kind of works as a joke, but I'm not sure, you know, actually watching my husband actually empty the dishwasher does not actually turn me on real life, even though the joke is funny.
Can we stipulate that there are some sexy chores, though?
Like anything involving
yard work?
Anything involving a duster?
I think...
That's from 50 Shades of Gay. No, that duster.
Like, 50 Shades of Gay, did you say, Rahana?
50 Shades of Gay. I did say that.
Oh, my
June,
God.
You are perverting my mind.
Hate
That's
crime.
What's happening.
I think that on a very, like, basic old-fashioned level, like, something that I find very difficult to do around the house, like, something that involves, like, a hammer and nails.
Oh, my God. Involves what?
A hammer and nails, or, like...
A ladder?
A ladder, yeah. Just, like, there are, like, dude chores...
A drill?
Stop. There are dude chores, and there are traditionally male chores, and there are traditionally female chores. And I do think that some women might find it sexy if a dude does the dude things for her.
That's exactly what the New York Times Magazine cover found, is that, in fact, in couples where chores were shared equally, there was less sex in the couple. Now, that's a pretty dubious study, too, but let's just accept it for a minute. There was less sex, particularly if the man did. They actually made the exact distinction you're making, particularly if the man did traditionally feminine style chores like cleaning and doing the laundry. And it was much less true if the man did, you know, traditionally manly chores. Now, I wonder if the opposite is true. They didn't test that thesis. What if the woman does traditionally masculine chores? Like, okay, June, now you're on the spot. In your house, who changes the light bulb? Who does the, like, climb up on the ladder and you know, take out the tools kind of chores?
I have a terrible confession, which is I basically do nothing at home. But I'm like...
So we should be interviewing Rosemary.
Yeah, see, I'm the breadwinner, and I don't do any chores. I don't cook. I don't clean out the refrigerator. I, like, it's terrible. But also, I'm shit at all those chores, so, you know.
That's the classically male thing.
I know.
Oh,
I'm
my
not
God,
good at it. No, I'm shit at everything, though. I'm terrible at all of the chores, male, female, whatever.
Yeah, and I would say in my household, we have a fairly traditional divide of things. You know, like, I do lady-style chores, and David does more man-style chores.
Am I the only one that has the reverse, where my husband, like, cooks and cleans, and then I'm the main breadwinner?
That was Anne, by the way.
Oh, no, sorry.
You can jump in. It's fine. I think that's interesting.
My husband sweeps and mops, and I really like it a lot.
Do you like it, or does it turn you on?
It's a joke that it turns me. Like, we say, like, because one of our first dates was me, or when I first went over to his house, he was sweeping and mopping, and I was like, that's so amazing. Like, now it's just a joke. It doesn't actually turn me on. It's not like that scene in My Own Private Idaho, you know, where...
You know what I think we need to conclude with this conversation?
Well,
that actually Sheryl Sandberg gets turned on by men cleaning. And that's it. That's the extent of it. Like, of people who actually get hot when men clean, there's one. An example of one.
Or use it as a bargaining chip.
Yes, or use it as a bargaining chip. And she can teach the rest of us how to lean in thus. Okay. Let's move on to our second topic, the trial in Silicon Valley. But before we do that, we would like to thank our loyal sponsor, Squarespace, a site that helps you start your own website. In the ongoing saga of my website with my son, which is so much fun, we have now unveiled it to his friends, and he's gotten lots of praise. I mean, you know, he counts the hits in units of one. Like, oh, three people looked at my site, but that for him is just like a big, wide universe. So he's really, really happy. It works well because there's lots of templates and choices, and the interface is easy. You have access to Getty Images. They also have a new feature called Cover Pages, which makes it very intuitive, and you can figure it out in very little time. As I've said before, we have used their 24/7 live support line, and it's only $8 a month. You get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for the year. When you sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code XX. That's DOUBLEX. You get 10% off your first purchase and show your support for the XX Gabfest. We thank Squarespace for their support. Okay, now let's move on to our second topic, Silicon Valley trial. The trial unfolding in Silicon Valley is uncovering how women are treated there, cracking the Valley's claim to meritocracy like an iPhone screen, as Natasha Tiku, a senior writer for The Verge, recently wrote. Ellen Pao, who is now the CEO of Reddit, is suing the venture capital firm of Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers for $16 million in damages, alleging gender discrimination and retaliation by an investor she had a brief affair with, who was later fired for sexual harassment. God, that's already hard to keep track of. Okay, Natasha, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I have to say, Natasha, reading your coverage, which I suggest all of our listeners do, is so pleasurable because you write with such authority, but also with such fun that it's like it makes it seem like sitting in that trial is like the funnest, most intriguing thing in the world. So you really have been doing a great job of covering it. So I'm deeply grateful.
It is really fun.
Good, good. Why don't we start just at the beginning for our listeners? Explain, what's Ellen Pao's main claim? Like, what is she claimed they did wrong?
As you mentioned, you know, it's a little bit complicated. So she's suing for gender discrimination and retaliation, as well as failure to prevent retaliation. And part of it is tied to this consensual affair she had with Ajit Nasre, who was a partner at Kleiner Perkins. But he had kind of pressured her into an affair, and she eventually succumbed, is the word used in the complaint. And she did not file this claim until she learned that he had sexually harassed another female partner. And
but it's not a sexual harassment claim, right?
Right, exactly. So she hadn't used the word sexual harassment really in any of her emails, even complaining about him and how he excluded her, until she filed a report after she learned about this. So part of the retaliation is saying that they treated her differently after she complained about sexual harassment.
So
the charges sort of snuck in there. But in the sexual harassment, especially if it was against the other female partner, that would be very easy to prove. He showed up to her hotel room in a bathrobe and slippers. She had to push him out of the door. and Nasre kind of, you know, treated her, Pao, in this way, too. Pao is not as well liked as the other female investor, whose name is Trey Vassallo. And Nasre was. He was very well respected as an investor. He had the ear of Ray Lane, who's running the green tech department. I mean, you can very easily see how those power dynamics can work in the office. And, you know, when she told the senior partners about this affair, they asked her what she wanted to do about it. This is not how, you know, a firm normally works. And true, it's not the number of people wasn't that high, but they have billions of dollars under management. They had invested in some of, and continue to invest in some of the biggest tech companies in the world. And so just, it's kind of inexcusable, their HR response to this. And so her retaliation claims are not only that Nasre, after she broke off the affair, excluded her, but also that when she continued to complain and complain, Kleiner started to treat her differently. And, you know, a lot of what we go through in court is not even these kind of things tied to Nasre at all. It's often just performance reviews where they talk about her in a way where you see kind of like this burden of expectations, where she should be not resentful for doing like menial tasks, but also, you know, don't be too ambitious in trying to invest in too many companies or sit in too many boards. And that's really the part, I think, that resonates with everyone. Unfortunately, that's not always correlated directly with the allegations in the complaint.
Well, I was trying to read the gender subtext in some of this performance review stuff that you wrote about, like the question about cockiness and sharp elbows and whether that's a good and bad thing and whether it works differently for her than it did for some of the guys in the firm. And, you know, whether like the bitch factors, like how did that all play in the trial? Did they try to portray her as incompetent or not aggressive enough or not a thought leader or whatever it is, the way people talk out there that you're supposed to be?
That's actually one of the funniest things is that Kleiner Perkins sincerely uses the word thought leader.
I love that. Yeah.
It's such a joke that it's just really funny, you know, hearing that her getting a salary of $560,000 versus $2.8 million depends on this kind of ridiculous buzzword.
What do they mean by you're a thought leader? What does that even mean? Like you gave a TED talk or what does that mean?
It means like, say you were initially one of the first people to say, you know what, all of the focus is going to be on smartphones. We need to, you know, forget, like you need to start building mobile apps. You need to start thinking about how your stuff looks on different screens. Like, so you kind of, they call it a domain expertise, which is much more, I think, just actually the basic definition. It just means you're able to kind of help push interest towards a certain category and that you are authoritative in that category. I think with venture capital investing, as much as it's high risk, they often all kind of glom onto the same idea. Okay, right now messaging apps are hot. So if you're the person who knows how ephemeral messaging works, you saw Snapchat early, then you know, you're a thought leader in that space.
Natasha, it seems to me and to this Business Week writer, Brad Stone, who I read a piece of his, sort of arguing that a lot of Ellen Pao's case seems to be structured around a sort of Sheryl Sandberg-esque vision of the world, like maybe even sort of cribbed from Lean In. Like a lot of things that Sheryl Sandberg has written about as being problems for women, you know, like not getting to actually physically sit at the table, being asked to take notes, are things that Ellen Pao has highlighted. Do you buy that argument that she's sort of, you know, she's seen the impact that Sheryl Sandberg has had in the tech world and she's using that argument to her advantage, or her lawyers are doing that?
I don't think so, because you can see her complaining about this well before Lean In was published. In fact, like, this is yet another tricky thing about the trial, is that Kleiner Perkins has argued that there should be a statute of limitations, which says that it can only be a year past the date of her filing, which was in 2002. But we're seeing as far back as 2008, 2009, 2007, she is complaining about some of these issues. I think it's because they are genuine issues, mm-hmm. and Kleiner has managed to make them look really petty. For example, in its trial brief, which is responding to her claims, it says like, oh, she wasn't, her office wasn't in the quote unquote power corridor, whatever that means. They seriously say whatever that
means. Oh, that matters so much. As a person who works in an office, it matters so much.
I know. So she is just like clawing her way to try to explain how being asked to take notes in a meeting is a big deal. And she's not the only one who complained about that. But I think, you know, Kleiner has, to get back to your question about personality, they have definitely had a very strict very subjective double standard about what she can say and what she can't. And that is problematic because she is kind of an acerbic person. You can see this in emails. I mean, it's hard, you know, it's like over the span of, she started in 2005 to 2012. Obviously, you're going to have some obnoxious emails during that time, especially if you feel like you're getting marginalized over and over and over. But they have definitely painted her as kind of a negative person, a dismissive person, without looking at the broader context of what was she complaining about? Why does she keep harping on these things?
One of the things I love about this trial is that I think it's one of the first to really well illustrate the way sexism exactly might work in this era? Like, it used to be much easier, right? You would point to laws that say a woman who's pregnant can't be hired. But now it's kind of insidious and hard to pin down and cultural. And I think her labored efforts and her side's labored efforts to define exactly what it looks like now is incredibly useful. I'll also say, Natasha, I love your descriptions of their lawyer, their attorney representing the firm, Lynn Hermley. Is that how you pronounce her last name? Like the kind of the kind of woman versus woman fight of the two of them. Can you talk about her a little bit and what it's like when she goes after Powell on the witness stand?
Sure. So Lynn is incredible. I mean, everyone's always staring at her. She wears these like very loud blazers. She's always cracking jokes. You know, she's looking at the room. She objects constantly, whereas like part of the reason that her cross-examination of Ellen Powell looked so damning or just confrontational and aggressive is Powell's attorneys were not objecting, whereas Lynn is just like firing it off. And she is really, really good at her job. I mean, she's worked for other tech companies too, you know, kind of on the wrong side of history in my mind, you know, like to get dismissed racial discrimination cases or sexual harassment cases. But in this case, she was just so well prepared. If Ellen Powell veered two sentences from the deposition that she gave in 2014, Lynn had the videotape of her saying the opposite or just something slightly different, like pulled up on the screen within a matter of seconds. And, you know, unfortunately, that really plays into the fact that she's kind of on trial for being likable and her personality. I mean, I think what you're saying is so true. It doesn't, unfortunately, I don't know that it will have bearing on the verdict, but this is the clearest picture of kind of the soft power of sexism that I think a lot of women are familiar with.
Reading the coverage, I've really been sort of torn because it seems that Ellen Powell was having a problem in the Kleiner terminology owning the room, and that Durr actually paid for her to be coached in owning the room and being authoritative. And apparently they failed to achieve that. I mean, in this extremely well-paid, extremely high pressure, this is the top of the pyramid, and it seems clear from the coverage that there were these, you know, that she was subject to micro indignities, and that to the extent that it's possible to chronicle these things, she has chronicled that she was treated unfairly. However, in this sort of, you know, crucible, don't you have to put up with just a million micro and macro indignities because very, very few people make it, period?
Well, wasn't there also, not to step on Natasha's answer here, but you wrote a piece about the testimony of Mary Meek, is her name?
Meeker.
Mary Meeker,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who had been a J.P. Morgan banker during the sort of first internet bubble, and now she's at Kleiner Perkins. And she got up there and said, you know, Kleiner Perkins is the most woman-friendly firm in the Valley. Like, look at me, I'm a success story. And I wonder, was she just carrying water for the firm, or is that, you know, a totally legitimate other point of view?
I mean, I think those questions are get exactly to the point, and they're related to each other. She was not able to, they do present evidence that she was not able to own the room, whereas Mary Meeker was. But I think that's also where you see a lot of the pattern matching come in, and pattern matching is used in the venture capital world. It usually means like, how am I going to figure out that like this 20-something dropout versus, you know, this 30-something woman who, you know, finished her education is going to have a better startup. Let me see who succeeded in the past. And I think this is where they're biased to what does owning the room mean? Why does it have to be somebody who is aggressive or confident? I mean, Chi-Hua Chen, for example, was one of the senior partners who was later fired, but he was promoted. And, you know, you talk to pretty much anybody here and they'll tell you that, you know, Chi-Hua Chen rubbed them the wrong way. And that didn't hurt him. So I think it's a matter of, yes, she was not able to own the room, but they weren't predisposed to listening to her.
That's a really good point and a great place to end. This is such an interesting trial. Again, Natasha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yes, and listeners, it's Natasha Tiku, and she's been writing amazing coverage on The Verge. So check it out, and we will have a link on our show page. For our third topic, we're going to talk about maternity leave. But before that, we want to thank a new sponsor, The Great Courses. I myself am an amateur photographer. I always have been, but I've always wanted to get much better. So last month, we watched a series that's part of the great courses called The Fundamentals of Photography. It was taught by a National Geographic photographer, Joel Sartori, and I have to say it was nothing like what I expected. I thought great courses would be like eavesdropping on a college lecture, kind of sloppy and disorganized, but it's not like that at all. It's clear. It's exciting. I picked up tips on doing portraits, on nature photography, both the basics of photography and also much more sophisticated stuff that I've always wanted to know. The Great Courses are celebrating their 25th anniversary. They've got over 500 courses and topics on history, science, literature, psychology, better living, basically anything you'd ever want to know, taught by engaging professors, top experts. You can watch or listen with DVDs, CDs, streaming, digital downloads, or the Great Courses app. So basically anything you can think of, they have made it very, very easy. The Great Courses has created a special limited time offer for Double X listeners. You can order from 8 of their best-selling courses, including the Fundamentals of Photography, at up to 80% off. Yes, that is a huge discount, 80% off the original price. So go to thegreatcourses.com/XX. That's XX, greatcourses.com/XX, and get started. Thank you. Okay, now let's move on to our third topic, maternity leave. This is an unusual segment. We're just going to take an intimate look at somebody's return from maternity leave, how they do it, what's involved, how it changes their identity, their relationship with work. We're basically going to put our own Jessica Winter, who has been many times on this show, on the spot and is just back from having a baby, from writing a novel, from doing all sorts of things. Now, I will say that this was June's idea for a segment, which makes it more kosher because June has anthropological curiosity about this. Right, June?
That's right.
Yeah.
Also, I'm really nosy.
Also really nosy. So, Jessica, welcome back. Can you tell our listeners the basics? When did you get back? When was your baby born? And just, you know, what's been kind of alarming and surprising to you about this transition?
Sure. My baby was born in mid-November, and I'm just back. So I had exactly 4 months off. 4 months off. 4 months on, just differently on.
Can we get into the nitty gritty of that? Is that typical at Slate? I never took my maternity leaves at Slate. I was always elsewhere when I had my children. Or is that something you had to create for yourself, or how did that work?
It was pieced together from parental leave, sick leave, some vacation I had hoarded, and to get it up to 4 months flat, I think I took 2 weeks unpaid. So it was kind of cobbled together. It was a much better situation than most women in America would have had. Friends of mine, when I was talking about planning a maternity leave, really encouraged me that if at all possible, I should try to go beyond 3 months because, Hannah, you know this firsthand, right around 3 months, the kid just starts giving more back, like all you've invested during the first 3 months starts being paid back in dividends, like smiles and coos and engagement and eye contact and stuff. And I am so glad that I took that extra month. I mean, 4 months in most of Europe, certainly in Scandinavia, would seem not that much at all. But in America, it felt, you know, downright luxurious. And I'm really happy that I did it.
So, Jessica, can you tell me, like, what were you doing? Like, because I'm just
taking care of a baby.
I know, I understand that. But, like, what did that look like?
What it looked like at first, the first month or so, was pretty grisly. I was learning how to breastfeed. And learning how to breastfeed is really hard. I mean, even if the kid latches pretty easily, which Devin did, even if you have a lactation consultant, which I did, it's hard. It hurts. The nipples have to be conditioned to this thing that you're doing all the time. The baby wants to eat all the time, around the clock. I was looking at the breastfeeding diary I kept during the first 5 weeks of her life, and it's horrendous. I don't even know how I got through it. I mean, I was pinned to a couch 16, 18, 20 hours a day, and that's typical. I mean, it's not like she was some crazy cluster feeder. That is just how it goes. So the first 5 or 6 weeks.
So I want all of you to think of that when you read today, when you from this week, that breastfeeding, is it worth those 4 extra IQ points that you're giving your child to be pinned to the couch 18 hours a day? I'm not saying it is or it isn't. I'm just throwing that out there.
Okay, can I just interrupt this important information to say that my cat keeps me pinned to the couch for a really like extensive portion of every day? So I can totally relate to your discomfort.
Does she scratch your nipples off and make them bleed?
No, she does not. No, she does not. Not anymore.
The thing is, though, actually June came into my office as I was reading through this diary this morning in preparation for this segment. I mean, when you're in it, you don't realize how bad it is. That's the thing about it. Like, looking at that book, if I had known how bad it was, I would have just stopped and said, you know, I'm going to the grocery store, I'm going to buy some formula, be right back. You know, I don't know whether it's hormonal or evolutionary or it was just a quirk of my own constitution, but I never, during that period, I don't think, ever looked up and said, this is crazy, and I don't know how many more weeks of this I have to go, and I'm going insane, and, like, please help me. I never had a moment like that. I had moments where I was a little weepy, or it was 2 a.m, and I just didn't know how I was going to stay upright. I definitely had moments where I thought, am I going to fall asleep on the baby and, like, hurt her? But there's just something, even though you are sitting still all the time, there's this kind of feeling of headlong rush to it, where you're just always thinking about what you're doing right that instant. You're always in this present tense. And so you never, at least I never looked up and said, what is tomorrow going to look like? What is next week going to look like? Because if it looks, like this, I can't do it anymore. And that kind of gets you through. And it's finite. You always know that it's finite.
I think of it like, when I look back on that period, it's like having an ecstasy trip in a really dark room in a club, or like being in Vegas. Like, you have no idea whether it's daytime or nighttime. Just time doesn't have any presence in your life. And so you're just like rolling through the minutes. I mean, I read whole novels in the middle of the night just because, like, I couldn't sleep, or my sleep was all messed up and I never knew when it was day or night, or sort of how 17 hours had passed. It's a totally trippy experience when you are out of it to look back and think, like, where was the clock?
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, minutes can drag and feel like hours. And yeah, sometimes you look at the clock and you don't know how the hands have spun around it. Yeah. Time becomes a very strange, druggy thing.
Jessica, what was your relationship to the outside world during your maternity leave? Like, were you reading the news? Did you check your Slate mail? Or were you like, screw it, I'm out?
I did actually keep up with the outside world because, you know, you are sitting still so much of the time. I always had my phone with me. I checked Twitter a lot. I read stuff on Slate or the New York Times or whatever. I listened to a lot of podcasts, actually.
Yeah.
And so I did feel tapped into the outside world in a way that maybe pre-social media or pre-the internet I wouldn't have. Mm-hmm. I imagine if I'd had this experience a generation ago, I just would have been on the phone with friends a lot, calling people at work and bothering them. And, yeah, please occupy me, help me. I read a lot. I reread a lot. Actually, I didn't quite have the IQ points that I needed to absorb news stories necessarily, but I thought it was a good opportunity to return to books that I remembered, you know, really loving and seeing if they held up.
And did they?
Absolutely.
Did they seem different?
They seemed hazier and dreamier and druggier. I read, actually, this is my recommendation for today. I read a lot of Don DeLillo. Don DeLillo is a great writer to read when you're kind of out of it and sleep deprived and don't really know what's going on, because his stuff is so, you know, paranoid and enigmatic. And, you know, he's a great, unexpected maybe, but a great maternity leave match.
And, oh my God, you've come upon just such an excellent genre. That's such a good idea. Like, when you're in that dreamy, hazy maternity leave, what should you read? We're going to ask our listeners to give us recommendations too. What should you read when you're in that timeless, sleepless state of new babydom?
Jessica, since we're probing your personal life, I should mention that you have an English husband, and you could have lived in Britain where you would have had 40 weeks of paid maternity leave, wouldn't have had any out-of-pocket expenses for having a baby. Were you tempted to go there? I mean, have you thought about how your life would be different if you were there?
You know, a friend of mine has two beautiful sons. Her husband is English. One of her sons was born here in New York, and the other was born in London. And so she is a perfect case study of, you know, not even which is better, but how grotesquely worse is it in New York compared to, you know, is it just a little grotesquely worse? Or like, and so, you know, I'm very envious of her situation. Yeah, we thought about it in the abstract before we were pregnant. Once we were pregnant, it was just, you know, the logistics of it were too unwieldy. It was just a matter of, you know, prepping our own house to get ready and, you know, figuring out our own stuff here. But yeah, it's something that I think about a lot. And, you know, I just wish we could get our acts together here in this country. But
Well, the one thing I have to say I resent in retrospect about my maternity leaves, and in general, it's been good. And I think having children took me out of institutions by necessity because of panic, but it just ultimately worked out well because it allowed me to work more freely and everything, and it worked out well. But the one thing I do really resent in retrospect is how every woman has to make it up on her own. Like, I think it feels cruel and lonely and isolating. And that's ultimately my problem with the lack of consensus on maternity leave in America, that every single woman feels like she has to make it up on her own. She's got to make these decisions, that it's on her if she wants to leave at like a normal hour, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's just like it's just the microcosm loneliness of it is cruel, I think. It doesn't mean I want like a massive government policy. I think all I want is a general universal acceptance that American workers are human beings who have human problems, whether they be children or parents or wives or the need for relaxation and vacation. Just like a view of the human being as something other than pure worker, even when they're in the office, is what I wish for the future of the American workplace.
That is so unreasonable.
No, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think if, at least if you look at the internet commentary, which no one should ever do, but you know, the frame of the issue is always so punitive. You know, well, you know, you should have, if you want an abortion, you should have thought of that before you had sex, or you know, if you want maternity leave, you should have thought of that before you didn't get an abortion, or like, you know, it's just always framed as punishment. And other people not wanting to have to pay for your sins, mm-hmm. or something. I mean, there's a cruelty to it that I have mercifully been pretty much completely insulated from, because I work at a place that's incredibly family friendly and incredibly supportive of women and mothers and families. And I am made aware more than ever of how rare that is now that I have a baby of my own.
Yeah. And I have to say, that's something I have, going back to our chore play discussion, slightly different, appreciated about my husband, is that he's like internally humane about how he runs a workplace. So when he was the editor of Slate, like, he intuitively understands, just as a person, the thing that I was saying, like, sure, people should go home at a certain time and watch TV or deal with their kids or hang out with their spouses or their friends or whatever. That's just, he has an internal work-life balance, I think, which makes him a good boss. And I'm sure Julia does too. Okay, well, thank you, Jessica, for joining us.
Thank you.
Jessica, will you stay and endorse with us?
Yes, absolutely.
So what is your endorsement today?
Well, getting back to what I was saying before about Don DeLillo as the great maternity leave writer, I just wanted to point our listeners back to his 1985 classic White Noise, which is a hard novel to summarize, but Wikipedia actually does a fabulous job of it. It's about, quote, rampant consumerism, media saturation, novelty, academic intellectualism, underground conspiracies, the disintegration and reintegration of the family, human-made disasters, and the potentially regenerative nature of human violence, unquote.
Wow.
White Noise. But the reason why it really stuck with me is that readers of White Noise will probably recall a classic multi-page description of a child crying. Wilder, the little toddler in White Noise, begins crying, and his parents are trying to calm him down, trying to get him to stop crying. It goes on so long that they take him to the doctor. And then after a while, the entire family, after hours and hours of this, just sort of surrender to this tsunami of crying. They just let it wash over them like some kind of natural disaster. And after, you know, 6 or 7 hours of crying, Wilder begins to take on this kind of mystery and dignity and power, because he just won't stop crying. And when he finally stops crying, everyone's sort of tiptoeing around him in awe, like he's somehow gone through some kind of rite of passage, and he's, you know, the magical powers have been conferred upon him because he cried for 7 hours straight. It's really a tour de force. I love it. People always talk about, you know, the first chapter of Underworld as Don DeLillo's crowning achievement, but Wilder crying in White Noise, I think, is actually his crowning achievement. And I read it aloud to my husband just to know what we might be in for later with babies crying. And we haven't experienced it just yet, but we're prepared if it happens.
That's excellent. June, what do you have for us?
So I think recently I described a shopping trip to Things from the Study in Soho. Well, there is a new pencil store in New York City, and I recommend it to everyone. So this woman, Caroline Weaver, started an online pencil site. She has new pencils, vintage pencils, and she opened a store, and it's so magnificent. It's near Grand Street. I believe it's on Forsyth. It's near the Grand Street subway station. And I just loved not only that this woman who loves pencils has set up this tiny store, and it's really, you know, just the, to me, the ultimate small business. So my endorsement is CW Pencil Enterprises on Forsyth Street in New York City. And there's also a website, which I believe is cwpencils.com.
I am recommending two things. First, Alison Bechdel's Fun Home. I'm embarrassed to say I just read it because we're going to all go see the play. It is so good. I love it so much. I just inhaled it. I just think it's fantastic. And the next thing that I want to recommend is the writing of Andrew O'Hagan in Tea Magazine.
So good. Yes.
I almost forced you guys to discuss his story Vanity Clause about male vanity and how it was destroying masculinity. The thing about his writing that's so amazing is, like, it's energetic from beginning to end. Like, he never drops his voice. There's no laziness in it at all. So all of you, go Google Vanity Clause. It is so pleasurable to read his writing on practically anything, but this one was especially funny. Okay, Noreen, your turn.
I've been watching The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt on Netflix, and I think I'm recommending it, although I am not all the way into it, and it started to get, like, a little maybe uncomfortable, whether it was upholding or exploding stereotypes. I couldn't quite decide, but it is mostly funny. So since that was sort of a mixed bag of a recommendation, I am wholeheartedly endorsing the Instagram feed. I have this thing with floors.
Which
is an Instagram. You know those Instagrams where there's like a cool tiled floor and someone takes a photo of their feet on a cool tiled floor? This Instagram just collects them all in one place. And it's really awesome. There are a lot of beautiful floors out there with cool looking shoes walking on them. So I can't recommend it highly enough.
Excellent. Noreen, I would say that you should read the story in Slate by Arthur Chu about race in Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which I thought was excellent. It, like, dissects exactly the way in which they play with stereotypes successfully and in which moments in the show it completely fails. It's really, really good. I mean, it was very, I liked the show a lot better after reading it. It made me like a smarter watcher of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
He's such a good writer, Jeopardy champion and insightful thinker, Arthur Chu.
Yeah.
Ohio native, I should
add. In praise of great writers. Okay. Well, thanks, Noreen.
Thank you.
Thanks, June, and thanks, Jessica.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Hannah. Thanks, everyone.
Our producer is Anne Hepperman. Our managing producer is Jill Meyer. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. That's P-A-N-O-P-L-Y. For what? For people who can't spell. Okay. Our show page for more information about the show, slate.com/XX. Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest for comments, suggestions about what we should discuss. Email is XXGabFest@slate.com, or you can subscribe to us on iTunes so that other people learn about the show. Thank you, and we will be back in a couple of weeks.